Well, even as the intractable Palestinian-Israeli conflict continues amid all the peace negotiations, the Bible reveals that a major military peril will not arise right within that region itself. It's going to come from a location which most people would never today imagine where it would come from. What does the future hold for Israel, and how will peace finally come to that region? Well, let's cover this topic today, and I've entitled this sermon, What's Ahead for Israel? You know, but prior to examining the scriptures that deal with the future of Israel, let's take a little more in-depth look at current events involving Israel. Give you kind of up to speed on some of these things, perhaps. And then also we'll take a look at the history of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that goes back for many, many years now. And it has no resolution, and there's good reasons for that. Not good reasons, but there are reasons for that. So we'll begin, we'll give an update on that today. A little later in the sermon, we'll cover top, as I mentioned, scriptures that deal with this. But if you recall, just a few days ago, really on December 23rd, the United States government chose to abstain from a United Nations Security Council resolution, which condemned Israeli settlements in what they called Palestinian territories occupied since 1967, including East Jerusalem. That's a quote that's from the resolution itself. The resolution passed with a 14-0 vote. Of course, the U.S. abstained in that. And it stated that Israel's settlement activity, and I quote again, constituted a flagrant violation of international law and had, quote unquote, no legal validity. So 14-0, you know, that's a lot of people standing against Israel. Of course, the vote was immediately denounced by Israel. A senior Israeli official accused the Obama administration of abandoning the Jewish state by its refusal to block this resolution, which it had done, you know, it has a veto authority, and for all these many, many years, it always blocked any type of resolution. This is the first time that it's actually happened. Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Dimon, stated this. He said, quote, "It is to be expected that Israel's greatest ally would act in accordance with the values that we share, and they would have vetoed this disgraceful resolution." However, of course, the Palestinians were very pleased by this vote. Mustafa Barghouti, he's the General Secretary of the Palestinian National Initiative, said this, and I quote, "This is a victory for the people and for the cause." We'll talk about the cause a little bit later. "And it opens the doors wide for the demand of sanctions on settlements." Reaction by many U.S. Republicans, Democrats, and various Jewish leaders in America was sharply critical of this U.S. action. For example, the American Jewish Committee's CEO, David Harris, said this, and I quote, "The administration's decision for the first time in 8 years not to block an anti-Israeli measure at the UN Security Council is profoundly disturbing." And then President-elect Donald Trump said this on December 24th in a tweet. Of course, you know he tweets a lot. He said, and I quote, "The big loss yesterday for Israel in the United Nations will make it much harder to negotiate peace." Also, U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan, he criticized the U.S. abstention as undermining America's historic Middle East ally. And, of course, in a vote just yesterday in the House, it was Republicans were joined by 100 Democrats to denounce what the administration did, and it won overwhelmingly in the House of Representatives. But anyway, Paul Ryan said this on just a few days ago. He said, "Today's vote is a blow to peace that sets a dangerous precedent for further diplomatic efforts to isolate and demonize Israel." And he said yesterday, he said that this vote came at the worst time, when Israel needs the United States the most. I heard that just yesterday. Well, Secretary of State John F. Kerry explained in a speech on December 28th that the Obama administration believed that the development, continual development of these settlements were an obstacle to peace. And he stated that having a moratorium on Israeli settlement growth on the West Bank would make it easier for Palestinian negotiators to come up with a compromise position. But interestingly, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tested this theory in 2009, and he had a 10-month freeze on new housing development in the West Bank. What was the result of that? Well, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas remained inflexible, didn't want to even negotiate, even after that 10-month freeze. And there's a reason for all this, and we'll get into that today. So the acrimony over this UN resolution indicates something. It indicates that conflict is going to continue, and it's going to happen for the immediate days and the years ahead. Now, let's review some important facts about the history of this ongoing conflict there in Israel with the Palestinians. And we have to go back quite a ways to 1917, because that's when the Balfour Declaration was declared, which on which Britain, Great Britain at the time, very powerful in the world, was the first power to endorse the establishment of a Palestinian national home, and I quote, "national home for the Jewish people." After a long series of events during the years between then and 1948, when Israel at that time declared its independence, and then the immediate war took place to drive Israel out of the area. Well, it didn't happen. As you know, Israel is a very tiny nation, and it's about the same size as New Jersey, which is the fifth smallest United States state. So it's a very, very tiny location, and it's surrounded by hostile neighbors. Some are a little less hostile than they used to be, Egypt and Jordan, but there are many threats to Israel all around the area there. So there's a great deal and it's steady, it's relentless, and especially with the help that the Palestinians, especially in Gaza, get from Iran, and then Hezbollah up in Syria and all this. I mean, they're just constant threats and pressure. Well, the core problem regarding these tensions in the area is that mainstream Muslims believe that Jews have no legitimate right to land there in the Holy Land. Sharia law, which is Islamic law, states that non-Muslims, including Jews, are not permitted to have rule over Islamic land. It's just part of Sharia law. That, again, I'll repeat, Jews or anyone who is not Muslim have no legitimate right to rule over land that the Muslims identify with and own. They feel they own it. Now, Muslims consent that Jews can live in the land. They have no problem with that, although the Jews have forever been under assault by Muslims. So they believe that they can live in the geographical area of Israel, But to recognize it as a Jewish state is anathema. They will not do that. How do you negotiate with something like that? And this is mainstream Muslims. And Hamas is on the right of that. I mean, very antagonistic. So even mainstream Muslims believe these things. To illustrate, Hamas, again, it's that fundamentalist Islamic organization that operates in the West Bank. It rules over the West Bank. I mean, over Gaza. It's also in the West Bank. States this in their charter. They have a charter. We have a constitution. They have a charter. It states this, and I quote, "The Islamic resistance movement regards Palestine as an Islamic waif, which is described as an inalienable religious endowment." Let me read this again. "The Islamic resistance movement regards Palestine as an Islamic waif consecrated for future generations until Judgment Day." So, I mean, it's like forever. That's how they view Palestine, they call it. Also, Mahmoud Abbas stated this. Again, he's the Palestinian Authority president. He stated this on Egypt's Dream TV on October 23rd, 2011. He stated this, "I said it before, and I'll say it again. I will never recognize the Jewishness of the state or a Jewish state." That was in 2011. We'll never do that. How can you negotiate? In an interview on January 20th, 2014 with Al-Sharq Al-Astate, he's in the Arab, an Arab international news, well, that he gave an interview with an Islamic international newspaper. Anyway, I'll just continue. I got that incorrect. In an interview, let me repeat. In an interview on January 20th, 2014 with Arshak El Astate, that's an Arab international newspaper, this man, Riyad al-Maliki, he's the Palestinian foreign minister, in discussing the Jewish nature of an Israeli state, stated this, quote, "It would be dangerous to recognize this Jewish state, because this would mean our acceptance of the dissolution of our history and ties to our historic right to Palestine. This is something..." I've underlined this. "This is something that we will never accept under any circumstances." That's where their negotiation position stands, and it will not change. In an October 14, 2013 article in Israel Hamon, this is an Israeli national daily newspaper, Israeli diplomat Zalman Jabal wrote this. No, this is an Israeli writing this, and I quote, "The real reason that Palestinians deny the national Jewish identity of Israel stems from Arab and Muslim unwillingness in principle to recognize the existence of a Jewish nation distinct from the religion. Arab Muslims say they are ready to recognize the state of Israel, albeit reluctantly, as a temporary refuge for the Jews that live there, but they are, and get this, but they are not willing to recognize the permanence of this entity." Now, they can be there, but they're not nowhere going to recognize the permanence of Israel. They shouldn't even be in the area, ruling the area. This is Muslim land, they believe. Any non-Muslim cannot rule there. So they will not recognize it as a Jewish state at all. And I don't know if you noticed, if you heard John Kerry in his speech that he gave a couple weeks ago, he said that Israel must decide whether it's going to be a Jewish state or a democracy. And if if Israel recognized itself as a democracy with the right of return for these Palestinians who left the area, within a few years it would no longer be Jewish in nature at all. It would just, and then it would become Islamic, and that's the end of the Jewish homeland. So they cannot do that either. So you've got these two intractable things that cannot resolve it themselves. So while Muslims claim the Holy Land, they claim Jerusalem as their own. This is contradicted by history. Daniel Pipes, he writes in the Middle East Quarterly of September 2001, he stated this, quote, "The Jewish connection to Jerusalem is an ancient and powerful one. Jerusalem was in fact made the capital of the Jewish people by King David in about 1000 BC, some 16 centuries before Muhammad, the founder of Islam, began the religion of Islam. And he began that in 610 AD. So David, you know, set Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, of Judah at that time. Now, let's take a look at the Palestinians for a moment. The fact is, ancestors of today's Palestinians never actually occupied Jerusalem until it was taken from the Crusaders by Muhammad in his wars of conquest there in 1187 AD. That was 2,000 years after Israel became Jerusalem became Israel's, I should say Judah's capital. So, I mean, you're talking long periods of history, you know, at this time. Also, we hear the term Palestinian. Well, there's never really been what they call a Palestinian people owning a land of called Palestine. For centuries leading up to World War I, the Holy Land was part of the Ottoman Empire ruled by Turkey. From 1918 to 1914, it was administered by Britain as part of the League of Nations mandate to them, and it was called Palestine after the ancient Roman Empire's designation for the area. Now, it's been called Palestine, but it's never been a Palestinian people that have inhabited that land. And at no time was Jerusalem ever the capital of a Muslim or Arab entity. Never has been. Even when the Jordanians occupied Jerusalem from 1948 to 1967, the Six-Day War in 1967, that's when Jerusalem and the West Bank were captured by the Israelis. Even when Jordan occupied Jerusalem for that long period of time, they never sought it to be their capital. Furthermore, prior to the Six-Day War, the Arabs in the West Bank were not referred to as Palestinians. They were considered Jordanians. And those in Gaza, we were always referred to as Egyptians. Also, considering all of this, it's not difficult to understand why there's no way to come up with a compromise situation on this. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is going to continue. Although the recent UN resolution, again, condemned Israel's building of settlements in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, the underlying problem, again, goes back to this issue of governance. You know, they have no right, from the Muslim perspective, to rule this land. They have no right to be there. Now, let's take a look for a moment as to how the Israelis rule in their land, the way they do it. It's a democracy. It's the only democracy in the Middle East where all citizens, including Arabs, those inhabitants there of Jerusalem and the West Bank, have full legal rights. Also, there are Arab judges in Israel, there are Arab Supreme Court justices, and there are government officials who are Arab in Israel. It's a democracy. And it's the one of very few countries in the Middle East where women have the right to vote. No. Let's contrast that to what's happening in the Palestinian, quote-unquote, areas. While the term of President Mahmoud Abbas actually ended in 2009, he's not called for any new elections because he knows that he might be kicked out of office, somebody else would come in. So you got to have, you got to have your power. And he's got the big name. So also Hamas, again, that's the terrorist group there in Gaza. They won elections, if you remember that, in 2006, but they have not allowed for any voting since then. So what kind of quote-unquote democracy is that? And also it's been interesting, too, about these contrasting methods of governance compared to the Arab states. For example, much has been made of the Arab refugees who fled the land of Israel from 1948 to 1967, but however, very little is mentioned about the Jewish refugees who had to leave all these Arab nations. How many of us have ever heard about that very much? And yet they were welcomed into Israel, of course, at that time. Also, Palestinian refugees have never been welcomed into Arab nations. They want to continue to keep them in these so-called areas of refugee camps. They have not invited them to come into the Arab nations, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt. They want to maintain this problem. They don't want to give them basic citizenship rights. So these are all facts that we have to deal with in understanding the situation. As a result of all this, the Palestinians and the allied Arab and Muslim countries have perpetuated this contentious situation rather than acting in good faith to resolve it. Because they feel like they don't have to, and they can't do it because of Islamic law. For example, Israel discovered in December 2000, following the Camp David II Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations with President Bill Clinton, that even proposing the idea of giving land for peace wouldn't work. Because when they did, they actually offered at that time, this is back many, many years ago in 2000, they offered 95% of what these Palestinians were asking for. A great deal of land, giving Gaza back to them, giving parts of the West Bank, and all of that. The result, they were completely rebuffed. In fact, when that came up, the Palestinian leader, Arafat, at that time, in fact, walked out of these talks, didn't come back. And Bill Clinton had egg on his face. He was very embarrassed by this whole situation, if you recall. He felt he was kicked in the head because of this. So that's what Israel gets for even bringing up the idea of giving land for peace. To further aggravate circumstances, Arab land sales to Israelis in Palestinian-controlled territories are outlawed and can be punishable by death. For an Arab in Palestinian-controlled places, if you try to sell some land to an Israeli, a Jew, you have the death penalty possibly hanging over your head. How many people are going to sell land to Jews because of that? Again, these are all facts. This is all documented facts. I've got it in my notes here. I've got all this documented. So all this really feeds into the narrative threatened repeatedly by Arab political leaders that any future quote-unquote Palestinian state has got to be Jew-free. No Jews can live there. In addition to all this, intransigence against any peace settlement with Israel was noted in a grand scale when Israel actually withdrew from the Sinai Peninsula in 1982 and from the Gaza Strip in 2005. Remember that? The Israeli troops went in there and just drug these Israeli settlers out of that area. They abandoned everything and they gave it to the Palestinian Authority. What happened? Actions against them intensified. Rocket attacks. I mean, that's been continuing from Gaza ever since. So land for peace doesn't seem to work very well. Doesn't work at all, in fact. So even though they took these unilateral actions, and there's various factions in Israel. There's liberal and conservative and all of that. Right now it's controlled by the conservatives, but there's efforts by liberal Jews to, well, let's try it again. Let's see what we can do, you know, and all that. So this is going to continue. So all of this is made clear in the Palestinian covenant and the Hamas charter, as I mentioned earlier. For example, Article 9, this is their constitution for the Palestinians. The Palestinian covenant, this is 1968 version, states, quote, armed struggle, now get this, armed struggle is the only way to liberate Palestine. That's in their basic constitution. This is the overall strategy, not merely a tactical phase. Goes on, the Palestinian Arab people assert their absolute determination and firm resolve to continue their armed struggle and to work for an armed popular revolution for the liberation of their country and to return to it. Also, here's another one. Listen to this. Article 13 of the Hamas Charter states this, quote, so-called peaceful solutions, and the international conferences to resolve the Palestinian problem are all contrary to the beliefs of the Islamic resistance movement. There is no solution, I'm continuing to quote, there is no solution to the Palestinian problem except by jihad, which means armed struggle against unbelievers. The initiatives, proposals, and international conferences are but a waste of time and exercise in futility. Now, let's keep going here. How about Article 15 of the Hamas Charter? States this, when our enemies usurp some Islamic lands, and this means the Jews are in the Holy Land, they're usurping our land. When our enemies usurp some Islamic lands, jihad becomes a duty binding on all Muslims. In order to face the usurpation of Palestine by the Jews, we have no escape from raising the banner of jihad. So, I mean, this is just, think about this. This is very grim. You think about this. Regarding any chance for peace under the current circumstances. And that's where it stands today. But what does the Bible tell us about the future? That's the important thing, really. What will become of the state of Israel? What's ahead for them, for that area? There's going to continue to be tension. There's going to be outbreaks of terrorism. There's going to be violence in the region. Constant flare-ups within that region itself. But as I said earlier, a major military peril will come from an unlikely source, and people would not even believe it today, where it's coming from. You and I know where it's coming from, because we're part of the choir here. We know where it's coming from, but most people out there in the world, and that's our job to tell people the truth about these things. Bible prophecy explains that in the years ahead, a reincarnation of the ancient Roman Empire will arise in Europe, So let's review coming events that Scripture tells us about. Revelation 17, you don't need to turn there, but I just want to mention it explains that an end time coalition of 10 nations or assemblies of nations will emerge in Europe. You know, you know this, but we're going to go through this. Linda and I were just talking on the way up here how important it is that we appreciate the knowledge that we have. We have to love the truth and the Scriptures, whether it be doctrine or prophecy. We have to love these things. We have to review them every so often so we are clearer on these things. So even though we've heard these things before, let's not just say, oh, well, I've heard that, but let's understand where all this fits in the picture of what we're dealing with in our world today. So this coalition of 10 nations or groups of nations are going to emerge in Europe, led by what we know in Bible terminology is called the beast. And it's a powerful leader. He's going to be a powerful leader of a powerful empire. The book of Daniel calls him the king of the north. Well, let's go to Daniel. Let's go to Daniel 11, verse 40. Daniel 11, verse 40. You know, various prophecies tell us that this restored Roman Empire will launch an invasion into the Middle East and North Africa. This will result from some unspecified action or attack precipitated by what the Bible tells us as the King of the South. We don't know what that will be yet. That's still to be determined in the future. The Bible tells us the King of the South is going to push at the King of the North. Whether that's an attack, we'll find out. We're going to be around to find that out. At least, hopefully, we'll see all this stuff happen. You know, somebody in the church will, if we're not here. That means if we're not alive. That's what I mean. Anyway, here in Daniel 11, verse 40, we read this. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him. King James says, push at him. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So as the prophet Daniel's passage reveals, at the time of the end, that's ahead of us here, many nations in that area will be totally overrun. We will be subjugated by the beast's awesome military machine at that time. And really, no more is said about the king of the south after this. He's going to overwhelm it. It's going to be history or histoire for the king of the south at that time. And this, again, the beast, he's going to drive his forces into the Middle East and North Africa. And this includes into Arab countries and also the nation of Israel. And just as Judea conquered that area over 2,000 years ago, it was conquered by the Roman Empire. It's going to happen again. And again, that's hard to even imagine today, but that is going to happen. The next verse explains what will occur. Here in Daniel 11, verse 41, it says, he shall also enter the glorious land. That's the Holy Land. That's where Israel resides right now. And many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He will, for whatever reason, he will not go into those lands. He will not overwhelm them and conquer them. They will probably be allied in some way with the beast. Verse 42, it says, and he will stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. So you're talking Middle East, North Africa, this whole area. How all this will come about, we just yet don't know. But tremendous geopolitical changes will take place. And this could very well result, I'm talking about worldwide changes outside of that area. So this could very well result in the shield of protection that the United States has ever since its birth offered Israel. And that will be probably taken away for this event to be able to take place, for the beast to get into that area unopposed. Luke 21, verse 20, if you go there now. Luke 21, verse 20. Jesus Christ prophesied that at the end of this age, Jerusalem and that area around there will undergo horrible, destructive times. It will be surrounded by enemies, by armies, rather, during these coming days of vengeance. Let's read about that. Luke 21, verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, right there, the beast's armies will be in Israel. Then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. So there will be great distress in the land, and the people will be forced into captivity and slavery as Judea or Jerusalem is trampled by the Gentiles. Here in verse 23, we read this, but woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. What people? The Israelis. And all of those Arabs and Islamic people in that area. Verse 24, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword. They shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem, what we're talking about today, will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, the prophet Daniel described this dreadful period as a time of trouble, the worst in all of world history. I'll read this now from the New Living Translation, Daniel 12, verse 1. It says this. You don't need to turn there. At that time, Michael, the archangel who stands guard over your nation, there's God, you know, God sets angels over nations, and I think we have that protection in our nation. But someday he's going to withdraw that, will arise. And there will be a time of anguish greater than any since nations first came to existence. But at that time, every one of your people whose name is written in the book will be rescued. So that's a promise that will take place. Let's go to Matthew 24, verse 21 now. Matthew 24, verse 21, for one little point here. So, you know, it's going to be such a period of intense chaos and turmoil that Jesus designated it as the Great Tribulation. He said in Matthew 24, verse 21, for then there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until the time, no, nor ever shall be. The New Living Translation puts it this way. I'll read it. It says, Matthew 24, 21 says, for there will be greater anguish than at any time since the world began, and it will never be so great again. So it's going to be a time of anguish, tribulation, distress, destruction, unlike the world has ever seen at that time. And various prophecies reveal that the length of that occupation will be a time and half a time, about 3.5 years. You think about 3.5 years, that's a long time when you're under distress and duress. It's going to be a long time. That's from Daniel 12, verse 7. Prophecy indicates that besides the children of Judah, other modern-day descendants of the house of Israel, including the United States and Britain and others, will suffer total humiliation and national defeat as a result of their sins as well. You don't need to turn here, but Hosea 5, 3 through 5 says this. This is from the New Living Translation as well. I know that you are what you are like, O Ephraim. You cannot hide yourself from me, O Israel. You have left me as a prostitute leaves her husband. You are utterly defiled. Your deeds won't let you return to your God. You are a prostitute through and through. and you do not know the Lord. The arrogance of Israel testifies against her. Israel and Ephraim will stumble under their load of guilt. Judah too will fall with them. It's talking about what we're talking about today. This event is going to take place. It's going to collapse the nation of Israel. Judah too will fall with these other nations. That's prophesied for our world today. We've got to get this message out to the world. Maybe we've got a little extra time to do that now. And we've got a big job to do. It's kind of amazing any of you who saw the Council of Elders meeting and discussing that new studio, I was just amazed. I was sitting there. They're approving this. We're going to go have this new studio. They've been wanting to have that for years. Have you seen how small the studio is that they've been using for all these years? It's just like it's not even bigger than half this room, you know. So we need that. We need that to get to the world. We need to promote this message around the world. We've got a big job to do. Maybe we have some time here to get that done. I know God is very merciful, but this is coming unless people repent. Zechariah 14, verse 1, if you turn there. Zechariah 14, verse 1. The Bible focuses, as we know, significant attention on Jerusalem. And it's going to be the epicenter of a supreme battle for global domination. The focus of the world will be on Jerusalem in the future. And it really is today in many, many ways. When you have 14-0 in the UN Security Council, that doesn't leave much room for doubt that it's going to be the focus of the future. Zechariah 14, verse 1 says this, "Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished." They're going to be raped. "Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city." So as this future conflict worsens, humanity will find itself perched on the razor edge of total annihilation. That is how bad it's going to get. Not one person will be left alive unless Christ steps in. We know that for sure. So at that time, God is going to step in. He's going to do it. It's going to be at the very last moment, you might say. He's going to step in mightily and powerfully, get it out. Jesus Christ will return from heaven with a massive angelic army to save humanity. Matthew 25, verse 31 says this, I'll just read it. "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all his holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory." He's coming. He's coming. God is planning this. The Bible reveals that at his second coming, the world's great armies will break off their attacks against one another, and they will instead concentrate their destructive energies against Jesus Christ, of whom they view as like an invader from outer space. The result will be what the Bible calls the battle of the great day of Almighty God. And it's often incorrectly described as the battle of Armageddon. But it's going to happen. Jesus Christ will employ his power, titanic power, to stop this monstrous destruction and suffering that's been inflicted on it by the beast and his allies, to the point where there will be, again, no living human being, no living thing on the planet unless Christ steps in. Let's go to Joel 3, verse 11. Joel 3, verse 11. So again, it's so important that we don't take these things for granted. We have got to know that we know these, and we, along with all the other doctrines, we need to not let ourselves get caught up as what happened in 95 before that. Remember, Lynn and I were just talking about that, how people kind of relaxed, and they think, well, I'm in a church, you know, I'm fine. And then it all came down, and they couldn't prove what they knew. So we, you and I got to know these things. That's why we study. That's why we have to study. That's why you have to constantly do that and pray to God for the help we need. So Christ is going to step in, and he's going to utterly annihilate these armies as they stand on their feet. They will not be able to get a shot off at Jesus Christ. He's going to pummel them. He will annihilate this enemy. He will deliver Jerusalem and the surrounding areas from the beast's hand. It says here in Joel 3, verse 11, assemble and come, all you nations. Okay, you want to have a fight? Come on, Christ is saying. You want to fight me? And gather together all around. Cause your mighty ones to go down there, O Lord. Let the nations be wakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Go down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. In other words, God's going to wipe out all of these people as they stand on their feet. The winepress, the blood is going to flow to the horses' bridles. How powerful is our great God and the promises that he has? So he's going to just do that. He's going to destroy them. And then after that, he's going to begin restoration. He's going to gather the remnants of all the 12 tribes who have been sent into captivity and slavery. He will establish his government. He will begin to establish it, beginning there in Jerusalem, and it'll spread all around the world. Jeremiah 23, verse 3 says this. I'll just read it. This is from the Holman Christian Standard Bible. It says, I will gather the remnant of my flock from all the lands where I have banished them. And I will return them to their grazing land. They will become fruitful and numerous. So Jerusalem will become God's global headquarters, and it will serve as a perfect and brilliant example of truth and righteousness and peace, unlike the way it is today. Jeremiah 3, verse 17, I'll just read this too. This is from the Net Bible. It says, at that time the city of Jerusalem will be called the Lord's throne. All nations will gather there in Jerusalem to honor the Lord's name. They will no longer follow the stubborn inclinations of their own evil hearts. Now let's go to Zechariah, if you would. Zechariah 8, verse 22. Zechariah 8, verse 22. The prophet Zechariah reveals that eventually people of all nations will seek God, the true God. Not these idols, not these false gods. You're going to seek the true God that you and I know, who has opened our minds to these wonderful truths, including what we've heard, we're here today, and all the other things that we are privileged to know. And we should never take for granted. That's the important thing. Don't let it just become something that you do. It's got to be your life. It's got to move and motivate you, all of us, including myself. Prophet Zechariah reveals that these people will seek God. It says here in Zechariah 8, verse 22, yes, my peoples and strong, many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to pray before the Lord. Imagine that when that day comes and how much we need to look forward to it. Also, remarkably, look at this, what Zechariah continues here in verse 23. It says, in those days, 10 men from every language of the nation shall seek the sleeve of the Jewish man. Look at how the Jews today are considered anathema. Look how many were killed in World War II in Germany. But that will not happen in the future. Let me read that again. In those days, 10 men from every language of the nation shall grasp the sleeve of a Jewish man, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. I want to learn. I want to be a part of this. Besides that, God prophesied through Jeremiah the joyful condition of the Jews and their brother nations during that coming amazing period. It says here in Jeremiah 23, verse 6, "In his days, Judah will be saved," talking about the future of Israel, "Judah will be saved, and Israel will dwell in safety." All the other nations that have been Judah's brothers during all these years. Let's go to Zechariah 12, verse 3. Several chapters ahead now. And as we wrap it up, let's recapitulate a little bit. You know, before these breathtaking events take place, there will be these breathtaking events of what Christ is going to do after he returns. But there's going to be terrible events, great conflict, great sorrow in the land of Israel and in neighboring countries and throughout the entire world. It tells us here in Zechariah 12, verse 3, "And it shall happen in that day," and when you see "in that day," that means the end times, "that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut to pieces." Again, it's going to be the center, the focus of all end time events. And look what it says. Those who would try to heave it away, try to dismiss it, are going to be cut to pieces by this. Though all nations of earth are gathered against it, it's going to cut them to pieces. Nevertheless, following that terrible time, Jesus Christ will establish true peace in Israel and in the nation. So you and I, let's look forward to that time. Let's pray for the fulfillment of that wonderful time. Let's stay close to God. Let's not take any of these things for granted, because we have no time to do that. We have to be focused on accomplishing the job of the church to reach the world with the gospel message and to prepare ourselves for that day when we will be able to rise and meet Christ in the air. And that day will be a great day for Israel and the entire world.